Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Joy Powers. Life in a small Great Lakes city can be challenging. The weather is often rough, the economy depressed, and the prospects often few. Despite those challenges, these places can still be a draw and even desirable for many.
And while the title character of Minnesota writer Leif Enger's new novel, Virgil Wander, is the protagonist, the town Enger imagines Greenstone, Minnesota, is every bit as important a character. Virgil Wander is Enger's first novel in a decade, and it brought him to Milwaukee recently for an event at the Oriental Theater. He stopped by the Lake Effect studio as well. Welcome. Nice to see you after quite a long time.
Yeah, well, it's really good to be here after such a long time, Mitch. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What inspired you to create this little city of Greenstone, Minnesota?
I think it was just a familiarity with the North Shore, a place that my family and I had gone to vacation and to cross-country ski in the wintertime and in the summer just to go and look at the, you know, the waves hitting the cliffs. It's such a dramatic place. There's something really gothic about it. And also, there's this beautiful tension that comes from a place being that gorgeous and yet that difficult to make a living in. So it seemed like that would allow for a pretty good story to grow up there.
The thing that strikes me about Greenstone is everybody, almost everybody, maybe everybody, is considering selling or quitting their job or leaving.
Yeah. It's getting ready to export everybody. I think, you know, if you spend much time in a lot of those places, a lot of people talk about leaving. And how can they do it? And yet a lot of them continue to stay because there's a pull, there's a magnetism to those little towns. When I was reporting for Minnesota Public Radio, I got sent up there on a regular basis and I would visit with people. And inevitably, they talked about leaving. And almost inevitably, they stayed.
Do you have to guard when you're creating a place like this, given your existing attraction to these kinds of places? Do you have to guard against over-romanticizing it?
I don't know. I think that I am certainly someone who romanticizes real hard. That's I don't really guard against it. I sort of embrace it, but then I try to pare it back as I'm working. You know, you come up with a scene, and if you're over-romanticizing, if you're pushing it too hard, then the scene becomes treacly and unreadable. And so you have to really temper it. Bring it back, utilize the tragedy that is also extant in all these little towns. You know, they're filled with that. They're filled with sadness and bad luck. And essentially, this is a story about a bad luck town in a beautiful place.
It's interesting. Just yesterday, in the same studio, I was speaking with another writer whose book plays out in kind of a thumbnail community in the desert Southwest among people who have moved there basically to be away from other people and kind of in doing so created a de facto community. Mm-hmm. But reading this book on the heels of that one, I am reminded of the inherent differences between the desert Southwest and the Midwest in that, you know, it seems like one of the pulls of a place like this and the things that keep people from leaving is the community feel. I mean, these people are connected to each other for good or bad.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think, you know, in some ways what I was doing when I wrote this was I was writing something I felt like I badly needed. My wife and I had lived at the end of a dead-end road for a long time, and I was feeling a little
lonely. And
that's
not a metaphor.
No, it's not a metaphor. It's a genuine dead-end road, and we were down there. We couldn't see, in some ways, wonderful. No light pollution. You could go out and see the shape of the Milky Way any given night in the summertime or the winter. But we were missing a community. And I think both of us felt the need for it. I would lie awake at night and read books that made me feel good about the world. And those all had to do with people existing together, for better or worse. And so I wrote something I desperately needed at the time.
Who were the characters in this book? I mean, there's obviously the title character, but who were the characters in this book that came to you the most easily?
The old kite-flying Norwegian, the eccentric Rune Eliasson came very easily. I wanted there to be this character who is from a place where the sun falls, you know, below the horizon in November and doesn't come up until January, that long night which gives rise to all kinds of possibilities and all kinds of magic. So Rune was just there right away. Nadine, who is the widow of Alex Sandstrom, who's been missing for 10 years, and a woman that Virgil, our narrator, has been secretly in love with for a decade and never told. She was just right there, just instantly there. Her son, Bjorn, who is 17, and finds solace by surfing on the just icy waves of Lake Superior. And incidentally, there's kind of a growing surfing community on all the Great Lakes. And if you know where to go just outside of Duluth, you see these guys starting in November when the gales start to rip and going right through the wintertime on their surfboards. Oh, man, it's attractive. If I weren't such an old fart, I would absolutely go out there and give it a try myself. Robin was like, you're not going to do this now. I'm like, well, we'll see.
So that you went there. That was the list of characters that came most easily to you.
They were right there.
Left off the list was Virgil.
Well, you did say aside from Virgil. obviously, Virgil was he was really an easy character for me to enter. And he actually didn't come to me fully formed right away. What happened was I wrote a first draft in which the main character was not named Virgil. He was someone else, and the story was told in third person. But one of my dearest and oldest friends then suffered a car accident in which she had a head injury and a traumatic brain injury. And when I went to see her after that, she was copying adjectives out of the dictionary into a notebook. And I said, "What is going on?" She said, "I can't remember any adjectives. I lost them in the injury in the accident." And that just struck me as being really interesting. So I jettisoned what I had and I wrote it again from the standpoint of Virgil Wander, who, at the beginning of the story, has suffered a traumatic brain injury by driving off historic Highway 61 into Lake Superior through a guardrail, and he loses his adjectives and also his balance and pockets of personal history.
There is another character you briefly mentioned in the background that we never meet directly, but who is at least partly responsible in some ways for setting the story in motion. Why was Alex's story so important to you?
You know, every small town has its mythic characters. When I was growing up in Osakis, Minnesota, there were a couple of guys named Tommy and Darwin, and they were 6 or 7 years older than me. And everybody knew that winter didn't really start until Tommy and Darwin got in their car and drove across Lake Osakis on ice that was half an inch thick. I mean, physically impossible, but they would do it, or at least that was the mythology. Did they ever actually do it? I don't know. Did they do it once and let people think they did it every year? I don't know. But when I was in seventh grade, we reassured each other that Tommy and Darwin had gone out and done it, and that's how we knew winter was here. There are these larger-than-life characters. And if you're writing about a small town, a good jumping-off point, those characters provide like a map of the area. And so Alex Sandstrom, being a man who had a moment of glory when he was a pitcher for the Duluth Superior Dukes, and he pitched the only perfect game in the history of the team, and then after that could never pitch the same way again. I just love that idea. There's baseball in my family. My dad was a pitcher. My Uncle Clarence was a pitcher. And I absolutely just took my Uncle Clarence, who apparently could throw 100 miles an hour but never knew where the ball was going to go. There actually were men in the Northern League who would not play if Clarence Anger was pitching because it just wasn't worth the risk. So a character like that you write about, and I realized when I was writing the baseball scene, the flashback scene, I realized that he was important. And so I tied him to the old man coming to look for his lost son.
What do Rune's kites mean to all the people that fly them?
You know, kite flying is kind of a major theme in the book. And it really just comes from the fact that when I was a kid, and to this day, whenever I fly a kite, I feel like I'm unhitched from responsibility. I feel like my imagination is free to go where it otherwise would not go. I feel like I'm in touch with something that is alive on the other end of the line, much like if you're hooked to a trout or a walleye and you feel that will on the other end of the line, that's very much what a kite feels like and kind of what it does. So there's an element of communication with something that is larger than yourself that you can't really see or understand, but yet it's there. So what I wanted the kite to do and ruin the Norwegian man who arrives looking for his son, stays up at night and designs and builds these astonishing kites, none of which are things that would actually fly. He doesn't make kites that look like butterflies or airplanes or birds. He makes kites that look like anvils and fireplaces and chairs and other things like that. To me, they just simply represent possibility. They represent the tendency or the freedom to wander.
There is a line that it so sticks with me, although I had to copy it down to make sure I got it right. But, you know, at one point, Virgil is out with Rune at night, and Rune is flying a kite and hands it off. And Virgil has no idea which kite it is that they're flying because
right,
he can't see
dark,
it.
Yeah.
And he said, Rune tells him that it's a curious privilege to fly without so much a glimpse or perception of the wing. And it seemed like the ideal metaphor for the way Virgil is living at this point in his life.
Yeah, absolutely. He doesn't know what he's hooked up to. He doesn't know what is what's in his future. Virgil has lived a life that was pretty staid, and where he knew the routines and they weren't about to change. He manages his failing theater. He works half-time at the city hall, being the city clerk for Greenstone. And things are just not really going to change. What I loved about that scene was it really does speak to the change in his life after his accident. And during his recovery, he is essentially a different man. He refers to his previous life as the previous tenant. It's like he's someone else now living in the same body.
You know, I asked which characters came the easiest, and I guess I'm curious whether there are characters that even today you still have a difficult time wrapping your head around exactly what makes them tick.
Well, let's see. I think the hardest character for me to get a hold of was Adam Lear, you know, and that's no surprise because Adam is mysterious. He's also kind of mythological in that he left Greenstone and went off and became sort of this rogue movie producer who was existing on the edges of Hollywood failures. And then he comes back to Greenstone for reasons that I never truly articulate because I didn't feel like I really needed to. But what makes Adam tick is a very different thing indeed. I really enjoyed writing him, but I feel like there are depths to Adam Lear that I did not fully explore. He was a pleasure to just bring on stage because I honestly never knew what he was going to say or what he was going to do. And yet there's something that is, I think, quite adequately frightening about him.
Hey, you say bring on stage. When you construct a book like this, do you imagine it as almost a play?
Not really. I guess what I mean by that is just bring somebody in to say something interesting and move the plot along. And I don't really think of it as a stage I'm constructing. And yet maybe that's not a bad way to think of it, Mitch, because you are bringing people on. And it is they do enter from the right or the left and say their lines. And I will say that he was one of the most pleasant parts of the writing for me just because he was so blasted unpredictable. I just didn't know what he was going to say, where it was going to come from. And so that made him fun to write.
As you mentioned earlier, you've recently moved from your longtime home at the end of a dead end road to the lake.
Yeah.
Into a place that's much larger than Greenstone. In fact, you know, makes an appearance as the big city in this book, Duluth.
Right.
What has the reality of living on Lake Superior been in just the short time that you've been there?
Well, it's the first thing I think of is we wake up many mornings to foghorns. We wake up to these beautiful, deep foghorns that kind of climb up the hill and rattle in the window panes, which is sensationally, talk about romanticizing. I'll wake up and Robin will be awake and just listening to the foghorns. It's kind of lovely. It really is. We live in an old neighborhood, and people there are very kind and very apt to say, well, this is going to be your first real winter, isn't it? Because we've not spent a winter in Duluth before.
As though on the Iron Range it was far warmer.
Right. And of course, I think that most of the time it was colder in Aiken than it's going to be in Duluth. because there's a little bit of a temperate factor. However, it is also true that Duluth gets 85 inches of snow per winter, and we used to get about half that in Aiken. Talk about your lake effect.
So check back with you in 4 months.
Yeah, I'm very excited about it because that's actually one of the reasons I wanted to live there. I love snow, and I love winter itself. The cold does not bother me, so far at least.
Important to get the book tour done with before that starts, though.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah, yeah.
Well, Leif Anger, it is a wonderful book, and I'm absolutely serious when I say I would like to pack up and move to Greenstone someday, maybe a good retirement place.
Well, things are on the upswing there. That's what I understand.
That's what I hear. Thank you so much again, and congratulations.
Thanks, Mitch.
Minnesota writer and former public radio producer Leif Anger's latest novel is called Virgil Wander. He's also author of two previous books, Peace Like a River and So Brave, Young and Handsome. He was in Milwaukee this month for a Boswell Book Company event at the Oriental Theater.